This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hey, this episode of Herding Code is brought to you by the App Quality Bundle. You can find it at buildbetter.software. This is the ultimate tool set for building better software. It's got six leading tools for one incredibly, amazingly low price. So you get a full stack of tools that cover integration, testing, monitoring for mobile apps, web APIs, web apps, etc. If you're considering upgrading to just one of these services, buy the whole bundle, you get the other five free. Services included include RunScope API monitoring, Ghost Inspector functional website testing, Circle CI continuous integration, Sentry exception tracking, Code Climate automated code review, and Xamarin Test Cloud functional mobile app testing. So the whole offer is $999 for 1 year of service for all of the six services I just mentioned. It's available for new paying customers only. Check out the website, that's buildbetter.software, for complete terms and conditions. And the offer ends on April 15th, so don't wait. All right, thanks. On with the show.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This show is being recorded on March 16th, 2015. And today we are talking to Rob Eisenberg about his Aurelia project. Now, we have talked to Rob before. Rob likes to make frameworks, don't you, Rob?
Sure. Well, I'd rather not, but people, but software development sucks, so I have to, basically.
So Aurelia is another entrant in the client-side JavaScript framework horse race with some cool, interesting features. So welcome, Rob.
Thank you.
But before we start talking about Aurelia, I just want to ask, you know, when we talked to you last, we were talking about your Silverlight WPF framework. And since then, I mean, do you still do any of that stuff? Do you still, are you completely web now?
I haven't worked on XAML platforms in quite a little while. I've actually, Caliber Micro is actually, I transferred ownership to another company that was made up of several people that were contributing regular to Caliber Micro already. And were, you may know Nigel Sampson. He was already contributing to Caliber Micro. He was put on the board for the new Microsoft open source. I can't remember the name of the group, but they basically put him on the board for that. So he was highly involved, and he was doing tons of work on Windows Phone and Windows 8 and all this kind of stuff. And so he was kind of the perfect person to basically pass the torch to on that project. So Caliber Micro is like doing fantastic. It's alive and well and still being used across all the XAML platforms and still being updated and all kinds of awesome stuff. But basically, I felt that since I wasn't doing XAML development as part of my daily job, then it wasn't really appropriate for me to kind of own that project. So I wanted to find somebody that kind of held the same values and perspective on software development and UI architecture that I did and kind of let them take the reins and continue to evolve that.
Cool. Okay, so you're a web guy now, and for a while you were working on this part of the Angular JS core team, right?
True.
And there was a, I won't call it a kerfluffle, but there was a bit of a to-do when you announced that you had kind of had a difference of opinion with the way that Angular was going, and you wanted to hop back over and work on your own thing with your own, that sort of matched your vision of where a client-side framework would go. And that's how we got to Aurelia. So we don't have to rehash that whole thing. But maybe you could talk a little bit about, like, what's different? Why, you know, what was it about Angular that you felt was going in the wrong direction? And what does Aurelia do that's different?
Sure. So for one thing, Aurelia really focuses on trying to let you write as much vanilla JavaScript code as you can. So we want you to be able to write ECMAScript 6 code and ECMAScript 7, of course, but that's, you know, kind of looking even farther out. But we want you to be able to basically write pure JavaScript code and to not have to do tons of extra work to configure the framework or provide tons of extra metadata. So kind of leveraging some of the ideas from previous libraries I built, just the notion of convention over configuration, which was very popular in the Rails world, which I think in the .NET world people like quite a lot now with MVC frameworks. And like I said, like Calibre Micro and Durandal both use that. So basically wanted to leverage those ideas more in order to let you just write very simple, straightforward, pure JavaScript classes. So that's something that's very unique. In fact, that's not just really a comparison necessarily to just Angular per se, but if you kind of look across the landscape today about how people write UI code in the JavaScript realm, you're not really going to find anything quite like that, that basically just lets you write a plain ECMAScript class and you're done. So that was a big part of it. Really wanted to focus on clean JavaScript code. Also wanted to focus on making sure that it worked good with different transpiled languages. So Angular was just focusing a lot on AtScript and Dart, and those both kind of troubled me. And I really wanted to have a framework that was written with pure ES6 and that worked nicely with pure ES6, but also worked nicely with ES5, worked nicely with TypeScript, nicely with CoffeeScript, and that actually from the beginning sort of certain abstractions or in the platform were designed in order to make writing idiomatic code in each of those languages easy to do. So that's kind of an aspect of that as well. There's a lot of details I could go into on clean code and stuff like that. How long do you want me to talk about this?
Well, that's a good start. John, did you have a question?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, one place where this is, you just posted today on your blog, it's side-by-side comparison, Aurelia and Angular 2 code side-by-side. And I thought that was really kind of helpful. I mean, definitely a lot fewer lines of code, obviously, and just kind of clearer. I thought, one thing that really jumped out at me was the difference in the Vue template syntax.
Right.
For instance, the binding syntax is significantly simpler. Do I give up something? I guess you're just saying it's by convention, it's like do what you probably want to do, and then you can be more verbose if you need to override or change the obvious kind of most likely cases. Is that what I'm seeing?
Yeah, that's basically the approach. Well, the templating syntax is something different, but if you talk about going back to just kind of the JavaScript part of things, mm-hmm. we have kind of simple conventions that we enable, and then if you want to provide more information to the framework because you want to do something different, you always can. And in fact, you can also plug into the framework and customize the conventions itself, so you don't have to. Again, if you want to follow kind of a different naming patterns or different organizational strategies, you still don't have to, if you're consistent about it in your app, you don't have to go adding tons of stuff throughout all your app code. You can just plug in to the framework and teach it your own conventions. But also, irrespective of that, you can on a case-by-case basis always override everything by providing some metadata to the framework to kind of tell it how things are different. In Angular, you always have to provide that metadata no matter what. In Aurelia, you only have to provide it if you're doing something that's kind of out of the norm. And the way you do that, provide the metadata in both cases, is a little bit different because, like I said, we focused a lot on having a nice experience for ES6 and ES5 and all these other languages, not just we support AtScript too. And we support the idiomatic way of doing it in AtScript. And TypeScript vNext and ES7 and all these, but we also support a nice way of doing it in the existing languages that doesn't get into writing kind of obscure code, which is kind of what you have to do. For example, if you were to, like the example from my blog uses AtScript, but if you were to write that in ES6, just pure ES6, you would have to kind of pull all those annotations off the top, put them down at the bottom, and then you'd have to write the correct data structures so that it gets hooked up onto the class constructor function correctly. And so you've got to do a lot more work because it really hasn't been designed to work nicely with plain JavaScript. And so that's different on that side. Now, when you talk about the templating syntax isn't using any conventions at all, except that .bind does what we call use the default binding mode. So when you bind things, everything is usually one-directional binding when you say .bind on an attribute, except for form controls. Those are two-way because usually that's what you want on a forms control. So that's the only convention we have there. But if you look at the syntax between Angular and Aurelia, there's drastic differences. And one of the reasons is that Angular is trying to create a syntax that they think will be more toolable. So they kind of have this vision that somebody is going to create really advanced tooling for Angular 2.0 that is going to do lots of fancy things with their syntax. So they literally try and embed a lot of kind of information into the syntax itself. And in my opinion, that this was another disagreement we had, which basically I felt like you shouldn't force people to pay a tooling tax, basically, for like tooling that doesn't exist and that nobody's committed to write. So it's significant. Like the type of tooling they're imagining is very significant development effort. I mean, we're talking some company has to invest millions of dollars to build it to really kind of leverage what they are trying to put into their syntax. And everybody else that's not using that theoretical tool has to pay the tax every time that they use any other editor to type all this stuff, which provides absolutely no value to them as a developer and just kind of makes them go through this exercise. And if you look at the syntaxes, I mean, it's much harder to, at first glance, kind of understand what's happening in the Angular scenario. There's a lot more going on there. There's a lot of weird symbols going on there. While that's technically standards compliant HTML, it actually will not work with SVG, and it will break DOM APIs as well. So that's actually a technical problem with what they're doing that was pointed out months ago that they had refused to fix. And so there's a bunch of kind of specific issues around HTML templating, the choices that they made there, and the community has responded negatively to that, and no changes have been made. And, you know, of course, I provided my own feedback internally before I left the project, but that didn't have any effect either. So there's some significant issues there, I think, on multiple fronts, on the tooling tax front, and also just on the literal technical problem when you come into looking at things like SVG or trying to set those things through DOM APIs instead of the standard HTML parser. So it just doesn't work. So they actually have a secondary syntax for everything. So they have two syntaxes for everything. So if it doesn't happen to work, then you can use the secondary syntax, which, again, is another design problem in my opinion. So I didn't agree with that either. This is all public knowledge. I mean, now that there's an alpha out there, I feel like I can actually tell you concretely, like, okay, here's something you can go look at, and I don't like it, you know, and here's how we did it different. So if you look at those examples on my blog, for the most part, speaks for itself. You can kind of see them side by side, and there's a pretty drastic difference in terms of just the amount of code, and I think even the readability and understandability of the code, especially if somebody who's never looked at your app before or never seen the framework before or any of these kinds of things.
So you mentioned convention. So can you give an example of some of the conventions that the framework uses and why you might like override them, for example?
Yeah, so for example, Aurelia lets you create custom elements, and you do this by creating an ECMAScript 6 module and writing a class and exporting that class. And the HTML compiler just assumes that if you're exporting a class from your module, it's a custom element. Like if you use it in your HTML, if you import it into your HTML, you import that module in and it exports a class, it just assumes that it's a custom element and that the name of the custom element is derived from the export name. So this is like real simple convention and it makes a lot of sense and it covers the majority of the scenarios. So you don't have to provide any kind of metadata or anything to tell it that. And as opposed to Angular, you've got to provide their annotations to indicate what CSS selector will match the thing and all this kind of stuff. So you don't have to do that. And that makes things a lot simpler, especially since you write a lot of code that isn't custom elements. You build things that are maybe just like your screen, and you don't want to create a custom element because you're not going to hard code that into HTML. You know, like you're usually going to have a router, and the router is going to route to different screens. And so you don't want to go through all that work when you're not even going to write the element itself, you know, in your HTML. So that's a difference kind of like that's an example of a convention where, you know, the majority cases you basically want this component and it's going to drive its name from the export name. And so you don't have to say that. And like in Angular, you do, even if you're never going to use the HTML element directly in code, you have to specify all that metadata. You can override it by providing metadata and say, well, actually, I named my export this, but I want the HTML element to be this other thing, for example. And we have simple naming conventions. Like when you create a module, basically, custom element is something you can create. You also can create something we call attached behaviors, which we're actually going to rename to just be custom attribute. So this is the idea of a custom HTML attribute that you can actually put onto existing HTML elements to add additional behavior. And so you can create them. Again, it's just a simple class that you export. You don't need any metadata because these all follow a similar pattern. So you can actually name it like foo attach behavior. And when we see that naming convention, much like in MVC frameworks where they, you know, have like foo controller, well, we know what it is. So if you name your class foo attach behavior, then we know that there's a foo attribute in HTML that maps to that. And because attributes have a single value, you know, you set the attribute value, we know that there's a single property on your class called value that the value of the attribute from HTML is going to map to. So we can set up all the binding, we can set up all the callbacks. You don't have to tell us anything about it, because that's just kind of the way it works. You just write a simple class with that name convention, and then you just use the attribute in HTML and you're done. So we also do that with value converters, which plug into the binding pipeline and can convert values while you're binding, while you're shuffling data into the view or when you're bringing it back into the model. So if you want something that's going to do like a currency formatting, for example, you can create a class and call it currency value converter. You just use the symbol currency in your binding expression and it works. So you don't have to provide metadata. You don't have to register anything. It just all kind of works. And these are pretty simple conventions to remember, pretty straightforward. And it's kind of like what a lot of people would do anyways, you know. So it makes a lot of sense.
Is the whole reason that Angular went with the being more verbose just around that tooling? You know, so that a tool has the metadata it needs to figure everything out without assuming conventions? Or
on the HTML side, yes. I'm not sure I completely understand the need for it all on the JavaScript side. An example of something else we disagreed on is in Angular 2.0, in your JavaScript view models, you have to declare all of the directives. If you're familiar with Angular, they have things called directives. Inside of your JavaScript, you must declare all the directives that are going to be used inside of the view. Frankly, this lit me up because that's just awful design, frankly. And I really have no shame in saying that this is just bad design. The internal implementation details of your view should not be reflected inside of your JavaScript and your view model. This causes a lot of problems with maintenance because now you can't just look at the view and see what's happening there. You have to shuffle back and forth to see, does this attribute actually something special? You know, well, I've got to go look over at my view model and see whether it's importing the thing over in my view model. And if you want to have different views against the same view model based off of maybe state or data, you then have to kind of aggregate everything together. At first, that wasn't possible with Angular, but I think they're making it possible. But you have to aggregate everything together. So you have to look at all the directives used across all your views, aggregate all that, and then put it in your view model. So there's just issues of coupling, issues of design, but this forces all that data to be in your view model. And so they wanted it there so that they could simplify lazy loading. So they could leverage the ES6 module loader to ensure that all the directives that a view needed were loaded automatically because the references were in the JavaScript. So that makes sense, but it's a design problem for just having separated presentation in general, and it's a maintenance issue. And so what Aurelia does is it actually borrows from ECMAScript 6 and gives you an Aurelia-specific import element in HTML. And in that way, you import things into your view that you want to use in your view. So if you want to use a custom element in your view, you import it in your HTML. So the view implementation is completely decoupled. The details of that, how it renders itself, are completely decoupled from what is in the view model. And you can see everything right there. If it's going to be some custom behavior that's used in the view, there's going to be the import statement there so you can see it. And, of course, we just do the work to extract that, and as part of our loading mechanism, we use the ECMAScript 6 loader itself to load up those dependencies of the view for you. So you get all the lazy loading stuff if you want it automatically, but things are in the right place. The view details are in the view, not in the JavaScript. So the answer to your question is that some of the stuff is done to simplify code on their behalf in terms of lazy loading, for example. So that's why you'll see some more code and some more metadata in the JavaScript that doesn't, in my opinion, belong there. But it's not that that's not a solvable problem. Like I said, we solved it in Aurelia, no problem. We handle circular references and everything. So it's just I don't really know why they didn't do that. I argued with them about this, but there was no real give on that. And in fact, because of this kind of design, it actually makes it impossible to implement certain types of conventions in Angular, because that metadata has to be there or else it cannot compile the view. So there's no way to basically say like, oh, well, I really like Angular 2, but I want to use conventions. So I'm going to write my own thing on top of Angular 2. Well, you actually can't do it. It's actually you're prevented from doing that kind of thing. And that approach just rubbed me the wrong way. A system that wants to support conventions has to have that baked in from the beginning. And it's much easier if you say we're going to support conventions but let you override things than the other way to try and like patch them up on top later, which, like I said, in this case, it's literally not possible due to their architectural decisions. So, again, there's a lot of what I think are sometimes kind of ivory tower decisions made that I just could not get any, you know, internally, I couldn't change any minds on, and I could not really understand. I could not really get a good reason why.
Ivory Tower at Google. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah. Angular. Let's talk more about Aurelia.
Yes. Sorry. Everybody asks me about this, and I can go on about it because I had legitimate reasons for leaving a very well paid job there. You know.
So I had various reasons for not using Angular 1. So
right.
not using Angular 2 to me is like, okay.
Right.
I'm not going to use this one either. So moving on. I like the way that you've done the class-based stuff in Aurelia. What would you highlight? Like I've got 10 minutes at the end of a meeting to convince my team that Aurelia is a good framework to consider and one that they should spend time learning. What would be your 10-minute or 2-minute, you know, pitch for the high points of Aurelia?
Yeah, I would very much stress the kind of standards-based clean JavaScript code. I would talk about the simple conventions where basically the way you build things in Aurelia, it's the same for everything, whether you're building a screen that the router is navigating to or whether you're building a custom element. You create a simple JavaScript class and you create a simple HTML view and you use a pretty simple binding language to connect them together and you're done. So you can decompose very complex screens into lots of small parts, but you follow the same exact patterns. So you really don't have to think too much. Once you learn kind of like the basic 1, 2, 3 patterns, you don't have to think about the framework at all. You can really focus on your application code. And in fact, when you look through your code, the code that you're writing in an Aurelia app, you primarily see your code. You don't really see the framework very much. And that's extremely important for maintenance, for the long life of the code. So if you do have a situation where you need to move to another framework, you don't have to be extracting present framework out of your code. So it's easy to read, easy to maintain, easy to evolve over time. I would also talk about the binding engine because the way we handle data binding is different as well. We have a very adaptive binding system and it's observable based. So when we write a binding expression in our view, we kind of look at the thing that we're binding and determine the most efficient way to observe it. So we use kind of a strategy pattern behind the scenes and it's based off of, like I said, the thing that we're trying to observe and the browser capabilities. So if it's like a plain JavaScript object and you happen to have object observe present in the browser, then we'll use that. If not, we'll write getters and setters if we can. If it's an HTML element you're trying to observe, then we understand kind of the event patterns there and we'll wire those up. And we can differentiate between, you know, whether it's SVG or whether it's, you know, this is kind of all abstracted. So you just kind of bind things and it works. And you can even plug in your own strategies. And this is the part that's really powerful that nothing else does. We can actually, for example, make our data binding system work with Knockout, or we can make it work with Backbone models, or we can make it work with Ember data. And the reason is because you can actually drop into the data binding system a little adapter, and its sole purpose is to basically identify an object that it knows how to adapt, and then to provide an instance of a particular, you know, interface, if you will, to our binding system. So if you're, for example, have some existing Knockout-based code, and you want to bring it over and start using Aurelia, you don't have to change those models. You'll drop in a Knockout adapter And in our binding system will recognize that, oh, you've got a knockout observable here. Here's how I observe that thing. And it doesn't matter. So we've actually tested this out, proved out our design with Breeze.js, which is a data library that's out there. You guys know Ward Bell, so that's kind of his company's done.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an adapter that lets Aurelia, our binding system, talk natively to the native events that the Breeze models publish. So you can use very clean Breeze models, but we don't have to do any kind of dirty checking against them. So if you use Breeze with knockout, you have an observable model, but you have the knockout functions everywhere. So that's a little bit less nice API perspective. If you use Breeze with Angular, you have the nice API, but everything has to be dirty checked. But if you use Breeze with Aurelia, you get the nice API and observability. Nothing has to be dirty checked. So you get the best of both worlds because we can adapt to the model. So we actually have adapters for Breeze that we proved out. We also have an adapter for knockout that we proved out, where you can just drop knockout models in and it just works automatically. So you can write those, and we suspect the community will write those. But I think this is a really powerful feature of the way that binding is implemented. And so we don't run into dirty checking performance issues that either Angular 1 or 2 could have. We get a nice observable system, but we don't force you to use any particular type of model. You can kind of observe whatever you want, and if it doesn't work out of the box, you can write a little adapter and drop it in and be done. So I would say that's a big selling point in my opinion, and kind of the whole framework takes this approach. This is more than 2 minutes, but the whole framework takes this approach of we really want to integrate well with other things. So there's lots of seams in the framework itself where you can teach the framework new tricks so that if you've got some favorite library X that you want to use, it works, and you don't have to jump through a lot of hoops to do that.
So I'm going to go a little bit deeper in one part here.
Sure.
We were talking about the binding, the two-way binding. You mentioned that under the hood you'll use object observe underneath there, and I'm wondering how that works with the transpiler. Transpiler? Did I say that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And what object observe translates into in ES5 world. Because I tried to do something similar to object observe using the old Gecko object watch.
Mm-hmm,
way
yeah.
back in the day.
Yeah, it's still around.
It's still around, but it's only, I think it's only in Mozilla, and it was only like, yeah. It was intended to do something with like Flash plugins or something weird.
Yeah.
It wasn't something that was ever supposed to be used and never made anywhere else. But I'm just wondering, yeah, so if you are using Object Observe underneath the hood, how does that transpile over to ES5 and other older, are there any browsers that don't support ES6? I guess, anyway. Who knows what
ES5 support. ES5 kind of comes in at IE9. So there's nothing as part of transpilation that does it, but at runtime, we kind of have a polyfill, if you will. It doesn't actually polyfill the Object Observe API, but it provides the same behavior. So we have a kind of a thin abstraction layer that's our binding layer. And when you bind to an object, if it's a simple property, meaning there's not an existing getter or setter, and you have Object Observe, we'll use that. But if you don't have Object Observe, what we do is we actually generate a getter and a setter. And then inside of that setter, we raise changes. But we don't do it in what I call like a more kind of a naive way. In other words, when you set the property, we don't just go fire off an event, because our polyfill is designed to have the same semantics as Object Observe. And Object Observe uses something called the micro task queue. And the micro task queue is relatively new capability in the browser. It came in along with DOM mutation observers, and it is it's a work queue, right? But it's different than the way the standard work queue works. So you may have used the standard work queue through using like a set timeout. So when you perform a set timeout, basically your function is going to get executed. You know, it kind of goes into this queue, and at some point in the future, after the timeout, more or less, the browser will execute that. And if your function then does another set timeout from inside of it, that will then be scheduled on the next turn of the browser. So in other words, it doesn't get queued up into the existing queue, if you will. It kind of gets queued up later after another turn. So what can happen if you use set timeout, if you're doing something that affects rendering, is you can get very bad performance, because every piece of work that's queued happens after a full browser turn. So you'll get like layout and render thrashing. But the micro task queue was designed to avoid this, specifically for DOM mutation observers, to make promises more performant, and also for Object Observe. And what it does is the micro task queue gets flushed after every kind of like user event. So imagine that you have a click event that executes your custom code. After that click event finishes executing, whatever's in the microtask queue gets executed. So it's asynchronous, but it's as soon as possible. And what's unique about the microtask queue is that if a job that's on that queue queues up additional work, it does not get pushed off to some other queue and get executed after some other event or after the next turn of the browser. That work will actually be queued up into the same queue, and that queue will continue processing until all work is drained. And this is super important for data binding engines, because you can have a situation where, you know, like maybe one property updates and then that triggers an update on another property. And if this is not done with the microtask queue, then you get very inefficient stuff happening because you get rendering issues, right? Because it gets pushed out across multiple turns of the browser. But when you're using the microtask queue, those things actually end up back to back being processed as part of the same queue. So it's basically, it automatically batches everything that comes through the binding system, including any kind of side effect changes, if you will. So this was designed, like I said, for mutation observers, which is basically the way of observing the DOM, for promises, and also for object observe, which is a way of observing objects, to be efficient, asynchronous, and to be batching. And so Aurelia, its fallback actually leverages the microtask queue to obtain the same exact behavior as object observe, even when it's not present. And there's no public API for the microtask queue. But if you have DOM mutation observers, you basically can implement it by creating an HTML element, then creating a mutation observer to observe a property on that element and toggling the value of that property. And every time you change it, your callback for the mutation observer will be called. And so you know that that callback is actually executing on the microtask queue. So it's a little bit of a hack, but it's a well-known hack. And in fact, we abstract this. We have a library called task queue in Aurelia. It's actually a standalone library. And one method on it is called queue microtask. So you can just put work on the microtask that way, and this is used by the binding system. So the result is that we actually get really efficient data binding, because even if you've got some event handler and you're doing some calculations and you change the same property 10 times and then you change a dozen other things, well, that all gets batched together and all gets processed at the same time right after the event handler. So your 10 changes to the same property actually end up being only one. So it ends up in one single DOM update, and then your other dozen things end up being their updates, but they all happen together on that microtask queue. So it's much, much more efficient than a lot of other observable-based systems. So if you take Knockout, for example, which is fantastic, it doesn't work this way, though, because as an observable changes, it's basically more or less kind of tied to the DOM element. So as you change the observable, the DOM element kind of gets updated. Well, where what we do is, like I said, it's queued up. But it's queued up to happen as soon as possible. But by that, having that slight bit of asynchronicity there, it allows us to automatically batch everything, and that results in much better performance. So that's the way Object Observe works. That's the way our fallback mechanism works, and that'll work on any ES5 browser. So we just generate getters and setters, and then we have an implementation under the hood that uses the microtask queue to publish changes. And, you know, that's kind of the way we handle most things. And if we can't observe it because there's a computed property or something like this, a getter or a setter, then we'll actually fall back to dirty checking. But the idea here is that the bulk of your system isn't written that way. So you get actually a very, very small number of things that need to be dirty checked. So you don't run into the performance with dirty checking, because there's just not enough of it happening to even matter. We can actually get around that, though, as well pretty easily, because like I mentioned, the data binding system is adaptable. So if you come across a scenario that you have where we can't observe it and we have to fall back to dirty checking, you can write an observer and drop it in, and then that pattern that you're following is handled. And the most common thing is computed properties. And we actually have a built-in way for specifying, like, hey, my full name property is actually based off of first name and last name. So therefore, you don't need to dirty check this thing. You can actually just observe these other things, and when they change, you'll know that full name changed. So we handle kind of the most common scenario out of the box. The fun thing about that, it's in the box now. The fun thing about that is that was actually written as an external plugin to the data binding engine using the hooks that I just talked about. So we actually didn't support dependency tracking on computeds automatically, but somebody wrote it and dropped it in as a binding adapter. And I want to say somebody, Jeremy from our team did, and then we just decided to bring it into the core. So that's kind of the power of the adaptive mechanism in combination with the power of leveraging the microtask queue and batching and kind of having different strategies to handle things in the best way possible. So we don't really run into a lot of the issues that come up in other binding systems, particularly issues that Angular 1 had with dirty checking. So those are non-existent, if that makes sense. Hopefully that's a good explanation for how we actually do it.
So does Aurelia provide any sort of, I'm not sure what the standard term is here, but the sort of the persistence layer of, you know, fetching models from a database, turning them into objects, all that sort of stuff, like a backbone model? Or do you sort of leave it up to the user to do whatever they want to do for that?
At this time, we're not providing a persistence because, frankly, persistence is a huge thing on its own, and there's so many different opinions on it. And, in fact, I've done it so many different ways across different projects that I have worked on that I'm not confident in coming up with sort of something that I think will handle a wide variety of the scenarios. What I prefer to do is say, like, hey, you like backbone models? Go use them, and then we can drop an adapter into our binding system. Or, hey, you like Breeze.js? Go use that. You know, we're really focused on the design of the framework being such that you can kind of bring other libraries to the table and use them and be happy that way. So we aren't planning a data library, persistence library thing, but we are planning to make sure that popular and common libraries work really well with Aurelia, and that we have examples and that we have people that are kind of working on those things and putting stuff together to show that. And then we can kind of document that and help people choose things or at least narrow down the choices for them so they can, so they're not left in the dark. But we're not planning that right now. We do have a validation library we're working on, which is kind of independent from the whole persistence thing, because validation is useful on its own, and that is completely decoupled from any particular model framework or anything like that. That's not quite ready yet, but that's an optional plugin that we're working. It's a kind of a fluent API style validation where you can just kind of declare the different rules and things for any arbitrary object, and then it kind of hooks into the binding system and works. We had a lot of requests for that. That's much simpler to kind of tackle something like that than an entire persistence library, and I'm kind of just hesitant to bite off something like that because it's massive. I mean, I actually built an ORM in .NET. I built three versions of an ORM, and thank God I never made it public as any kind of open source project because it was really complicated. And, you know, the client side has aspects of all that kind of stuff too, and I just don't want to go down that path. There are other people that do it pretty well, and there's so many different opinions. I'd rather point somebody to something else and then make sure that it integrates well with us.
Everyone wrote an ORM in .NET. Don't feel bad.
Yeah, I know. It's I've done a lot of open source. So I just always am thankful that I never actually like put that out on Codeplex. At the time, it would have been Codeplex, or probably some of it was pre-Codeplex, really.
Got .NET.
Yeah, I'm glad I never put it out there because, man, that would have been a real pain to have to maintain.
Did you just say got.net?
Got.net, flashback.
Oh my gosh. There's a name I haven't heard in many years.
You know, I was wondering, like, persistence, the idea of, like, PouchDB or something like that. I'm wondering if anyone's looked at that.
I don't know PouchDB.
It's pretty cool.
It's a local browser implementation of CouchDB's replication protocol.
There's actually a PouchDB?
Yep.
I thought you were kidding and just misspoke.
I was not, and I didn't make a mistake. No, we actually talked to, I forget, the guy at Cloudant. We talked to him, and he mentioned that.
Was it on our podcast?
Yeah.
I gotta pay attention.
Yeah, more. You should check out our podcast sometimes, guys. It's really good. But one thing that was cool about Pouch that just caught my attention is that it's a local in browser, but then it can also sync. You know, so
I'm gonna contact these guys. That looks fun.
Cool.
That's fun. I mean, there's so many of this stuff out there, and like, you know, it's a significant. I'm just looking at their website. I mean, this is a significant undertaking on its own, and so I'd rather let people that are very passionate about this and kind of experts in this build that, and then just make sure that it works well with our stuff. You know.
You know, I mean, so as you were talking before about just like change tracking, dirty checking, and the microtask queue and all that, that drive like. often I'll hear people say, like, there's too many frameworks. I don't want to deal with a new JavaScript framework every week. I'll just write my own. Like, you know? And I mean, just the, like, what goes into making something like performant and handling all the issues. And we haven't even talked about security and, you know, I mean, just all kinds of crazy, like.
It's easy getting started, but very quickly it falls apart. And I wouldn't attempt this if I hadn't kind of been down this path more than once. And I'm very passionate about UI architecture and this kind of stuff, but I do not recommend it because there are so many gotchas. Even in the modern DOM, you know, like I was talking about our binding system and how it's adaptive. Imagine that you have an HTML element and you want to data bind an attribute. Well, there's no single DOM API that will cover every scenario. So you've got your typical attribute, which maps the properties, and that's nice. So that works really well. So you can have a binding system that just sets properties on the element. That's great. But then you have things like ARIA attributes that don't have a property equivalent. They have to be set through the attribute API. You have things like SVG, which also has to be set through the attribute API, but it has to be done a particular way because it's namespace, but the normal way of handling namespace things doesn't work in HTML5 or whatever. Then you have XLink attributes, which again, they have to be handled slightly different because of namespaces and HTML5 issues, and that's different from like SVG. And then you have whatever data dash attributes. Data dash attributes map like to this special property on, you know. And so there's not like one single way to, like, if you wanted to implement a data binding system, there's not a simple way to even write the code that sets the value on the element, right? Because there's all these special cases. And you think it's simple at first, you know, because you're binding, I don't even know, your href on your a tag. And then all of a sudden you go to do input controls and you realize you've got to wire up multiple events on them to make sure you handle all the input. And then all of a sudden you have, let's see, what was the thing that, yeah, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I want to bind some SVG here, and then it breaks and you don't know why.
That doesn't even cover, like, all the times that you inadvertently cause some gigantic screen redraw.
Yes.
just by the way that you're setting those properties.
Exactly. That's why the microtask queue stuff is really important part of Aurelia, because that kind of gets us around and lets us batch everything, you know, together and avoids some of the nasty stuff that would happen if you were to, you know, if you kind of had an immediate update in your binding system that causes problems, or if you tried to have a queue but it was based off a set timeout, you would have problems with, like, you know, kind of side effect updates and things like that. And yeah, it's non-trivial. It's really non-trivial. It starts out easy, and then as you start to try and build a real app, you start coming across these different cases. Like, you know, another example is like, there's all these things that don't map, that the name doesn't map the same from the attribute to the element property. And then you got to deal with like the style attribute, which is totally borked, especially in IE. And you got to deal with like CSS classes, you know, because you want to bind those. So the property name doesn't map and the API is different. And, you know, it's like, all this, so we're just talking about binding now, and we're not talking about like routing or actually having some kind of component model or doing custom elements or any of these other things. So it starts to get hairy real fast. So it's very non-trivial to do. I don't recommend you just go out and write a framework. I'd love for you to contribute to Aurelia. So hopefully we'll have a nice welcoming community, and I think it is, and people will get involved and take ownership there. And it looks like people are.
All those problems are taken care of by just typing npm install and then some verb. And you'll get something that does whatever you want, right?
Right.
I ran into a lot of those problems that you're talking about when I did a little dynamic JavaScript loader. And just the number of ways to really find out if an element just exists on the page, let alone, you know, if it's loaded finally. We're way more than I expected.
You probably want to put if I at the end, like Existify, something like
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I just installed Spotify, it.
Bindify. That's really all you need. Bindify.
Bindify. Yeah, it gets complicated.
I got a quarter says if I type npm install bindify that something will come back.
You mentioned SVG a few times, and that's near and dear to my heart. Is there, are people, like, as an example, I was screwing around with React last week, and one of the things I was like, well, like I could bind some SVG elements and stuff, and it all worked. But then I started thinking, like, what would I really use this for? Like, I mean, I guess I could use it for charts. I mean, what do you see people or do you think people will use Aurelia with SVG?
You know, it's a bit more of an edge case, but it's something that a framework has to support. That's the thing about having like a production quality framework that you want to go tell people about, right? And let people use, is that somebody has a legitimate use case to do that, and it has to work. Mm-hmm. So you got to have to solve those problems. There's not a lot of that. I'm trying to think, you know, if you're doing like sort of graphically oriented things like charts or drawing applications or mapping type applications, there are certainly uses for things like that. I can see that there might be custom widgets that want to render themselves with kind of more advanced rendering with SVG, where they want to be able to leverage the data binding system for some aspects. I don't know. You can imagine somebody that writes like this custom button element that actually has a button internally but renders itself with SVG, and it wants to have a – I'm not saying you should do this, right? But somebody will do this and want to do this. You know, he wants to have a corner radius property on the button, and – you know, the SVG needs to be like rendered based on that. But then he wants to data bind it somewhere to some slider so that he can provide maybe like a WYSIWYG editor, or, you know, people do all kinds of crazy things. That's definitely one thing I've learned just as a consultant and building frameworks and having, you know, working with people that have used the frameworks and seeing, or sometimes just seeing what people do. People do really insane things all the times in their app, at least what seems to be insane. But then if you actually sit around a lot of times, not all the times, but if you sit around and dig into their use cases, you'd be like, oh, okay, I know why you did that. I know why you had to do that. You know, that doesn't happen all the time, and people still do bad stuff, right? But
yeah.
But people also do really crazy things you would never expect, and they have legitimate reasons for doing that. And a framework has to be able to not – you don't want people hitting walls, you know, when they're using your framework. And so you have to kind of handle those edge cases. And that's the not very fun part of a framework, because it's really awesome in the beginning when you're like, this code is so simple and look at how our data binding system is awesome. And then all of a sudden somebody's like, what about SVG? Because I need to do this. And you're like, oh. And you start writing the code to do that and you realize that you don't actually know how to do that. And then you go Googling all around and find out that it's totally quirky and you got to figure that out. And but then when you get that solved, somebody's like, I want to bind a data dash attribute. And you're like, and you know, I don't even use data dash attributes at all. Mm-hmm. Like, I never really got on that bandwagon, and I don't think there's a huge use for it most of the time. But you know, a lot of stuff like Bootstrap uses it or whatever. So it's like, oh man, now I gotta go figure this out. You know, so you just have to do it. It's not pretty, but you have to do it.
You know, at my last
job, you tell those SVG folks. Oh, sorry, Kevin. You tell those SVG folks. You say, go use Angular. Leave me alone. I've got stuff to do.
No, I was just going to say, at my last job, we had started the process of converting our image sprites over to be SVG instead of bitmaps. And that's just for little like icons and stuff, right? So then you get like scalable graphics, and you don't have to have, you know, retina versions of your icons and stuff. And it actually is a great use.
Mm-hmm. And that's why your last job is your last job, right?
Well, I was thinking
that, I mean, that's not an obscure case. That's a totally, you know, reasonable case.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking this weekend, I, as a joke, was doing a little quick code pen thing with a bouncing Wumpus for Jeff Atwood. And I was thinking, like, you know, there's really, I mean, it was like 4K, and it's like, I mean, I don't know. It's, you can do quite, and then I was thinking, well, what modern browser doesn't support SVG anymore? They all do. Yeah.
Pocket yep. IE.
Yeah.
Okay. So since John mentioned React, we have to go there.
Of course. That's the other one.
The other darling right now out there, and the virtual DOM and all that stuff. So what's your take on that?
I have mixed feelings on the whole thing. I think React is fantastic as a renderer. I'm not sure it's really great as a framework for building apps. I'm not sure that on the larger scale that it's really great that way. I have a number of issues. Like I said, I make different design decisions. So the thing I don't like about React is just the kind of Yeah. So React is not a framework, but it gets used like a framework a lot. Sorry, I just
typed that in. I said that, I get that a lot. People are like, "Oh, I want to use the React framework." No, it's not a framework.
Yeah, it's a library call for rendering.
Your code.
Right?
Library, you call libraries. Frameworks call your code. That's the difference.
Yeah. So one thing I should point out, actually, and I have a sample, kind of a small sample of this on a blog post, is that you can actually use React with Aurelia. And so you can actually, say, write a custom element in Aurelia. And this is an area where you would break with the convention. You would basically say, you provide metadata that says this element has no view, basically. And that's going to tell the engine not to go look for the HTML template, not to parse that, not to data bind it, not to do any of that. And in that case, you can handle your custom elements rendering internally any way you want. And so I actually have a sample on the blog that actually shows how you can write a custom Aurelia element and then use React as the internal renderer for that particular element. And that works fine. It actually works great with – we do all our ES6 transpilation with Babel, which lets you mix JSX in with your ES6 code. So you actually get a really nice product in terms of the way your code looks in the end, because you can have your JSX there and then you can have your Aurelia exported element there that just calls the render function internally, because Aurelia will give you the HTML element instance. It will do it through DI, so you can get an instance of that. And so you can just tell React to render into that element whatever you want. And the really cool thing, of course, is that you can, if you want to actually use data binding, you can still do that, because your Aurelia component can still declare properties, and when you use it in HTML, you can put binding expressions on that. And then what you would do just internally is you would get callbacks for when those properties change, and you would just re-render with React. So you wouldn't care about doing anything other than when any property on my custom element changed, I'm just going to use React to re-render, and this element uses its virtual DOM, and React handles that and does it very efficiently. So you can actually build Aurelia custom elements and completely not use the HTML templating engine that we have, but instead use React as a rendering engine today. And then you could get the sort of experience for putting maybe the larger pieces together using Aurelia and using the router and using DI and some of these other things in different ways. Or you could build everything in Aurelia and be like, oh, well, this one thing has a performance issue, or these few scenarios have a performance issues, and Aurelia's templating engine it's not cutting it for us, whatever. I don't know if this would happen or not, but I'm just saying theoretically. Oh, well, you could just drop React in and solve that problem. And Aurelia doesn't care. So I think React is great as a rendering library, and I think the virtual DOM is really smart. I think it's a really cool idea, and I hope some of those ideas actually find their way into the real DOM, because there could be some really interesting things that could happen in the browser if some of those concepts kind of became part of what the DOM itself can do. But I don't think React is great as a framework. A lot of people do try and use it as a framework, and I think that at that larger scale, if you're trying to use it that way, I think there's maintenance issues and other things, and you usually have to cobble a bunch of things together anyways. I think React is really smart. I don't think it's the only thing that I would use, and I would tend to lean, obviously, towards Aurelia because I like the approach better. But I would also just tell people that, hey, you can use them together because React does some things very, very well. And if you need that for certain cases, then, use it.
So is a sort of virtual DOM-based approach something you would consider adding natively to Aurelia? Or you just say, well, if you need that, then use one of these other libraries too?
I'm not considering adding it natively, because it would be a massive set of changes. And I'm not sure entirely how things would really work in terms of the templating engine, which is just used to talking to HTML. And I'm not sure how that would actually play out with our data binding engine, which, like I said, is actually extremely efficient in the way that it batches changes. So it's not clear to me that I would get a win for the average scenario that way. I'd much rather, like I said, focus on letting it be something that people could drop in where needed, if needed. So
it's kind of like the data persistence thing. Let the people who are really passionate about it do it.
Yes.
Okay, so we got to talk about the other JavaScript buzzword of the day.
Uh-oh.
Isomorphic.
No, we don't do that. I kind of have the opinion that that's a transient thing. Other people might disagree with me, but I don't know if that's going to be something that's going to be around for the long term. I kind of feel personally that the web is going to continue to evolve to have more rich application experiences, and the server to do less rendering, and the server to be focused more sort of on providing APIs. That's my opinion. Who knows what will happen, but I don't see the server-side rendering thing being that big of an issue.
So for people that aren't familiar with that, isomorphic is where you're rendering your first hit, you're rendering on the server, and then later you're doing all the rendering on the client, and the two are in sync.
Yeah, more or less. And those problems are kind of being solved also by the browsers and by there's the SEO thing that kind of comes into this as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason people do this. And some of the SEO stuff is being solved by the search engines. And a lot of things that are single page apps today are usually behind some sort of login or something like that. So it's a bit less of an issue. A lot of our use cases, too, evolve around mobile and desktop native apps, too. So that doesn't apply there. But I kind of see the web is continuing to evolve in such a way that the isomorphic thing in the long view kind of doesn't really continue to be a thing. And there are ways to solve it. You know, there are actually services out there that will solve this for you by rendering your stuff, and you can spin up a server to kind of handle this that will work with any single page app, not just Aurelia. And I'm not sure that actually kind of re-architecting Aurelia to be able to handle that, when I don't know that it's going to be a big deal for a long time, is worth it, especially since typically the kinds of architectural things you do to make a client-side development experience really nice and really performant and to solve those kinds of unique issues are very, very different than what you would do for most cases on the server. Now, we mentioned React because that is different, but again, React's not a framework, it's a renderer. So it's actually very straightforward in the case of React to accomplish this. But for most single-page app frameworks, it's a really different kind of a beast, what's happening, you know, what you would have to do on the server, really, versus what you would have to do on the client to make it efficient and work right. So I'm not sure that we're going to go down that path, because there are ways to deal with it if you need to. And I don't think it's going to be an issue for a long time.
Yeah, it just seems to me like, I mean, very big picture and kind of like you said, but there's pretty clear different use cases. Like if I'm building an app, I mean, I still see a pretty clear distinction most of the time between sites and apps, you know?
Yes, and I wouldn't use Aurelia to build a site. Aurelia is about apps.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, those lines are blurring, but you can do kind of hybrids, but you can solve those issues. But I really see Aurelia as more about apps.
Okay, so we have some questions from Twitter. Why don't we tackle some of those? So we have a question from Cecil Phillip. What is the rendering perf like compared to React.js?
Yeah, so we haven't actually done a lot of sort of comparing performance with other frameworks. It's actually extremely hard to do that in a way that is honest, but I think it's important. React is fantastically fast in particular scenarios and less good at other things. So I think it's important to point out, I don't have an answer to that question, but what I want to do is point out that there are different kinds of performance, if you will. So usually when people are talking about performance with React, they're talking about initial time to render, and they're not talking about time to update. So something that's an observable system by its very nature, whether we're talking, I don't want to generalize, but for the most part, observable systems are going to be faster to update, if they're built correctly, than something like React, which is essentially a dirty check system. But React is going to be much faster on its initial render time, because it doesn't need to set up the observation infrastructure, if that makes sense. So like I said, I haven't done the comparison, but if I had to guess, I would say that React is probably faster for initial render time, and that Aurelia is probably faster for updates. Because, like I said, we have a very efficient batched observable-based system there. And so we literally just do much less work whenever something changes. I don't know that for a fact, and you know, maybe we'll try and prove that out. But like I said, it's hard to compare apples to apples when you're talking about even frameworks that are so different and the approaches that people use to build things. So you can do like these micro benchmark type things, and those are totally not real world. So it's hard to compare. But the thing I would say is, remember that there's different types of performance. There's initial time to render, you know, like time to get that first thing up on the screen. Then there's kind of time to update. And there's also animation performance as well, which is kind of a separate beast altogether. And I could say that React is probably faster on initial time to render right now, but we haven't actually done our performance optimizations yet. So Aurelia has really been focused on developer experience. Like I said, standards, clean ES6, kind of getting the design patterns right in terms of decoupling things and proving it out with real-world apps that are being built. And then we basically have been keeping a list of known things that we can improve, which we think will have pretty massive positive performance side effects. And we're about ready to start basically going to pretty serious hardcore performance optimization. But we're not comparing ourselves to other frameworks as part of that, really, at this point. We're kind of comparing ourselves to ourselves. And we would basically want to focus on doing as much as we can to make things as fast as possible. And then maybe we'll kind of see, like, is there a realistic way that we can compare to another framework? I so much don't care about being the absolute fastest framework out there. I think that you need to be fast enough. And my basis for that is something like Rails. I mean, people didn't pick Rails up because it was the absolute fastest thing in the world. They picked it up because they could be really productive, because the code was clean, it was maintainable, it was very rapid development, convention over configuration. And for most things, it was fast enough. And if it wasn't, then you went and you did some work and it was fine. But I think that we will be competitively fast in the end after we've finished our performance optimizations. And if it may be in the end that React is still faster for initial time to render, and I actually don't have a problem with that because we will be fast enough. So that's kind of my goal, but we're going to start by comparing to ourselves and not worrying about outside. And there's a ton of really, just talking about why you don't want to build a framework, there's a ton of really bizarre knowledge you have to have in order to really squeeze performance out of JavaScript. And that's fortunately something I've been able to learn over the last year or so. And I've kept a long running list of all kinds of bizarre things we could do internally without affecting external APIs that would have pretty big effects. And so we're about to start doing those. And I'm pretty positive it's going to be a huge, huge performance boost. But like I said, it's not slow now, but it can be much faster. And so we want it to be as fast as it can be. And that's what we're going to focus on first. So I don't know if React is faster or not. But there's different types of fast.
So we had a question from C-Sharp Fritz, Jeff Fritz, saying, can you talk about what led to the choice of the architecture with JSPM? And maybe you can start that with explaining what JSPM is for those who aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, so JSPM stands for JavaScript Package Manager. And JSPM is an open source project that is a package manager. It doesn't particularly have its own package repository. It uses things like NPM and GitHub as a repository for package. But JSPM focuses on client-side package management, and it does so by having extensive knowledge of module formats and also being forward-looking towards ECMAScript 6 modules. And it integrates nicely with another library that's kind of part of the whole package, if you will, called System.js, which is a module loader built on top of the ECMAScript 6 standard module loader API. So what you can do with JSPM is you can say JSPM install Aurelia framework, and it will go out, it'll find it on GitHub, it will download the latest release, it understands semantic version, it understands dependencies, so on and so forth. And it will actually set up the a configuration so that the module loader that you use that actually loads your code in JavaScript understands that it's working with a particular module format, that it understands where those files actually live. So if you ever work with something like Require.js, you may have had the unpleasant experience of having to deal with map and path and shim config. And you don't have to do that usually with JSPM because it actually generates that automatically because it has a deep integration between the package manager itself that literally downloads and puts the code somewhere on your file system and the ES6 loader that loads it at runtime. And of course the bundling capabilities it has as well. So it can set all that up for you so that you can have the same experience as many native platforms for basically importing libraries, because you install it, and the same name that you use to install it, the same identifier, say like Aurelia Framework, is the same identifier that you use inside of your ES6 module import statement. So you get a one-line plugin install on the console, and then you get a Very simple, straightforward, one-line import into your actual JavaScript code, and everything matches directly there. So JSPM facilitates that experience. It's one of the few things that I know that is kind of forward-looking, that has good support for ECMAScript 6, and has this idea of providing a nice integration between the package manager and the loader itself. Now, Aurelia itself is not dependent on JSPM at all. All of our loading that we would need to do is abstracted through a loader abstraction, and you can actually plug in other loaders. So we have people using that are not using JSPM and not using System.js. We have people that are using Bower and require JS. So you can use those together. We actually have people that are using Dojo and Bower. A lot of people working with Esri to do mapping stuff, that's still based off of Dojo, and they want to use Aurelia. So our abstraction actually works with that too. So you don't have to use those. We kind of feel like JSPM with System.js is kind of the closest, nicest experience for working in the world of ECMAScript 6 modules and packages to give you this nice one-line install, one-line import experience, and to kind of get rid of some of the nasty stuff that you may have dealt with in require.js. And it makes all the different module systems work together. So you can import something that was built with AMD and it configures it right. Then you can use that from your ES6 module. And then you can pull down some common JS library and use that, and it just all works. So that's kind of our out-of-the-box recommendation when you're building Aurelia apps, but you can use other things. But we just think that it solves a lot of really complicated problems very nicely and gives you a pretty clean developer experience.
The one feature I want out of JSPM is I want it to have internal rate limiting against GitHub, so I don't have to go in and configure my... You know what I mean? Configure my credentials.
So that's going to be solved, actually, because we actually bumped up against this a lot with Aurelia in the beginning, even before we launched, because Aurelia itself is not one gigantic library. It's like 20-some-odd smaller libraries that are designed to collaborate, and those are each independently released and versioned on GitHub. So when you say install Aurelia framework, it actually has to bring down a whole bunch of libraries. So we had problems hitting the GitHub rate limit easily, especially if something went wrong or if you're using a starter kit that also had other libraries or whatever. So we've been working with JSPM a lot because the Aurelia community is providing a lot of like really good real-world use cases for this. And so Guy Bedford, who runs that project, is actually there's an issue track for this, and it's actually being worked on where there will be different ways of – basically, the reason that happens is because it uses the GitHub API in order to support GitHub release stuff, which can be kind of unique. But most projects don't use that on GitHub. And so the normal web-based API can be used, which has no rate limit. And so, for example, that what you just talked about is going to be solved because in the future, most packages installed from GitHub are not going to use the GitHub API. And if something has to, then basically that's kind of treated as a separate package repository that you pull from. And the only thing that we know of that really needs that is Bootstrap.
Hmm.
So Bootstrap can kind of be configured to do that automatically behind the scenes. So you can still install Bootstrap and it will use the GitHub API, and then everything else coming from GitHub will basically use the non-rate limited stuff. And so, yeah, that's a pain, but it's like well acknowledged and there's a plan to solve that. So hopefully you'll be happy.
So I have a short rant.
Sure.
About JSPM and basically the entire Node and NPM ecosystem.
well, this shouldn't take long.
Yeah.
Well, and for you bingo listeners out there, this is Scott's NPM rant.
This is a scheduled NPM rant. So the biggest thing that they need to do with all of these packaging systems is they need to, they need to use the existing config files for items that they're using internally. So if you're using Git to connect to something, you should honor the existing Git config and Git excludes and whatever else you need to that you've got set up in your home directory, period. And they also need to test these things out behind corporate firewalls and proxies.
Yeah, I know. You followed that one issue And I sat on it for a long time before I fixed it for you. I think it's fixed now, but yeah.
Well, you didn't sit on it for a long time. It was like a day or two. It's not like, oh, it's been years. I'm still unable. No, you fixed it really quick. I was happy about that. But it's still not something that you can fix because I think it's something internal to JSPM, the fact that and this is internal to NPM and Bower and all these other things.
Yes.
The fact that I have to go hard code a proxy somewhere versus it just using, or I have to export it into my environment. Let's, you know, be fair.
Yeah, the fact that it doesn't use the system-wide proxy by default,
exactly,
is very irritating. It also means that stuff like Fiddler doesn't work.
Right. And yep. So when you go and you export these things, then suddenly, you know, everything in that session is going to use that. So, and the way that, and not everyone has competent network admins.
Right.
So, you know, so some places I've worked where, you know, you set up a proxy and then that means you can't get to stuff internally because you're going out and then coming back in through the proxy, mm-hmm. which is also very slow. So, yeah, that's my big NPM rant. That and the fact that, you know, they need to hurry up with the version 2 or whatever it is that flattens out all the package and dependencies.
Oh yeah, that's a huge deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a big deal for I'm pretty much on Mac these days, but that's a huge problem for Windows because you can't delete.
Yeah.
Like you get these deep things and then Windows tells you like this path is too long. I can't delete this. I don't know why they did that, but one thing I like about JSPM when it imports from things is it uses a flat structure that has the package version as part of the folder name. So you can actually have multiple versions of the same thing, and it knows how to resolve them correctly. And yeah, so hopefully they will get that. They will get that done. Has anyone actually? Do you know if anyone's actually reported to them?
Yeah. There's an issue on it, and it's actually being addressed for NPM v3.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then I've been using, there's a few NPM packages. There's flatten packages package, which just gives you a command that does all, basically flattens out the hierarchy. Yeah. Which, you know, I mean, I can see instances where it could break things, but it's worked for me so far.
Well, maybe if somebody at Microsoft could support like a real file system that doesn't have these stupid limitations, this wouldn't be such a problem. I mean, really,
like
I mean, at this
effort.
Point,
we
255
have,
characters, give me a break.
How many years we?
Yeah.
How many years we complaining about this, John? It's like the support for managed add-ins in IE, right?
I've lost track of how many like, emails I've sent on this, and it's just kind of like.
it was a yearly thing with the managed in for IE, I think, and every year we'd get on and ask them, and they would say, sure, we'll consider that. And
yeah.
I think the same with Long Pathway. And the greatest about that, it's not just that they don't support the long file names for deletion, it's that they go ahead and they create the long path,
mm-hmm.
and then you just can't delete it. Not like an error when it's trying to create it. That's the best part. That's pure bliss for
and the
me.
Completely sad thing is that there is support in Windows. There's UNC file path support for 32,000 characters in a path. But the problem is that nobody will, like, everyone's waiting on someone else to support it. So, like, Explorer doesn't support it. And, you know, of course, there's probably 900 Raymond Chen articles on, you know, why they can't change anything about Explorer ever, you know. And then, like, Visual Studio won't support it because they don't want to create files that you can't open in Explorer, and Explorer doesn't want to support it. And everyone's waiting on everyone else is my read on it. So probably this year so far, I've sent off like 5 emails on it. It's just like, I think we're going to get NPM v3 first.
Right. Yeah.
I think we're going to get NPM v7 first.
Yeah.
I think we're going to get that database file system for OFS. I think we're going to get that
for FS.
Oh my! Let's bring it back.
we should like move to some sort of high notes to I mean, as because we can't end on talking about file path length on Windows. That would just break everyone's heart. I had just a question that I don't think we've gotten into too much, but as far as kind of like I understand this is completely. You know, front end, it's browser side. Are you seeing any kind of patterns or like, for instance, I saw somebody request like a to-do MVC version of Aurelia. Are there any kind of things that you're seeing as like, I mean, I know Breeze, I guess, is kind of a, I'm just trying to think about, you know, is there kind of a standard way or something? I mean, obviously you'll see people building Node apps and hopefully ASP.NET 5. And I don't know if there's any kind of server side stuff you're thinking about.
You know, we're going to put together, so we have a skeleton that It doesn't really have any server-side stuff, but is just a starter kit, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We have people that are using Aurelia with all sorts of things. So we're gonna have a CLI. So this is something that will be coming before release. And we're going to basically open it up and make it really easy for people in the community to create starter kits across different, you know, so basically you can come in and say, well, like, well, I'm working on like Windows with Visual Studio and I want an MVC backend.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make it real easy to kind of get set up with that by people and let people who know how to set that up the right way do it. So we have people using it with like .NET, we have people using it with Python, we have people using it with Ruby, we certainly have people using it with Node. So, I mean, people are basically using the quote mean stack with Aurelia. One guy wanted to name it the Amen stack. he wanted to rename it that, which I thought was pretty entertaining. But so people are following the same kinds of patterns, if you will, that they have for in terms of front end, back end type stuff that they have with other frameworks in the past, and it's working out well. Is that kind of what you're getting at? I mean, there's the to-do apps. Are we going to have more samples? So we've got our starter kit that has a basic navigation sample. I've got another sample in a repo called app-contacts. This is like a contact manager app, and we're actually going to be expanding it out with some more features and then produce a video tutorial series that builds it from scratch. And we're going to have several other, like, different kinds of sample apps that are kind of in different categories, you know, like maybe a dashboard style app, maybe a more tab-based interface type app. This contact manager is kind of like a master details kind of thing. So we're going to have those as samples. And we've got, I mean, I hate to-do apps because you don't use a framework to build a to-do app.
No.
Because you can write like 100 lines of JavaScript and be done. But, and so they don't really exercise or show off the intricacy or, you know, the interesting details of any particular framework, I don't think. But we will have a to-do app because, you know, we have to have it. We have somebody that contributed one for to-do at MVC, and I need to review that. There's a few issues that need to be fixed with it. So, but we'll have that soon, and then people can look at that and see how to write a really complicated, I mean, you know.
Yeah. A real app, right? I mean, I'd like to see somebody do, like, instead of to do, like, a master details with a tree view on the side, or, you know, but something kind of standard that's got multiple views, that's got something that's slightly non-trivial.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So as we bring this into a close, so where are we at in kind of the life cycle of Aurelia? Like, are we, like, pre-beta? Are we at alpha? Are we, like, what's a 1.0 look like? Where are we at?
Yeah, so right now I'm kind of more or less in a preview or an alpha stage. So we're basically telling people not to go to production. You can build real apps with it today. It's pretty feature complete. There's a couple of small things missing. But if you need to go to production tomorrow, you shouldn't be using this. So we're targeting a beta in about 3 months from now, we hope. And that will be something that we would feel comfortable enough to say, well, it's not released, but you can go to production with this basically because it's feature complete. We've got a lot more testing on it. We've done a bunch of our performance optimizations. We've locked down the API because beta I kind of actually see as a pre-release, because once we get to beta, the way I've kind of approached it with other libraries is once I get to beta, usually it's like almost release. I just kind of like to let it sit for a little bit and make sure that anything unexpected doesn't crop up before we give it the release stamp. So we're hoping to get there in about 3 months, and so the big things that we're working on for that are bundling, which is just needed so that you can deploy all our performance optimization stuff that we talked about, a few missing features, and we want to lock down the API so that there aren't any more breaking changes. We're trying to get those out of the way as soon as possible, so actually the next few weeks there's going to be a few kind of sets of breaking changes, but then we'll pretty much be done. And then we need more documentation, of course. We've got a pretty cool strategy around that. It'll be fun. So an alpha now totally has enough feature complete to build just about anything you want, but don't go to production with it. Don't think about building an app with it that needs to go to production unless you're targeting something 3+ months from now to be in production. I told you, so now you know. People do crazy things. So if you're a crazy person out there, you're hearing this, you don't try and go to production with it next week. But and then after that, like I said, we're going to try to get the release as soon as possible. We're just going to kind of wait and see, you know, if, what kind of bugs or other issues crop up. And if things look good, then we'll do a release. So.
Cool. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Rob, for coming on the show and join us again another time for Hurting Code.